Support for WPR comes from the Woodson Art Museum in Wausau, with the 50th annual Birds in Art exhibition. New avian-themed works from around the world through January 4th. LYWAM.org.
This is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau, and we're talking about self-sufficient organic gardening on the show today. Our guest is Elliot Coleman. He has over 50 years of experience in all aspects of organic farming, and he's the author of The New Organic Grower, Four Season Harvest, and The Winter Harvest Handbook. And his latest is called The Self-Fed Farm and Garden, A Return to the Roots of Organic Method. What questions do you have for Elliot about organic gardening? And we can take other vegetable growing questions too. So give us a call. Our number is 800-642-1234, or you can send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. Elliot, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
I don't know what the weather is like in Maine, but here it's going to be in the 60s in southern Wisconsin. It's kind of odd to be thinking about that, but how has your weather been on that side of the world?
Similarly, much warmer than normal.
Mm-hmm.
By Thanksgiving, I'm usually skating on the pond, but it doesn't look like it'll be that way this year.
Yeah, it sure doesn't seem like it, does it? Now, many people know your name. You're a leader in the organic gardening movement. Basically, you were organic before organic was cool. What got you interested in gardening that way?
I read a book written by a Vermont couple, Scott and Helen Nearing, and the book was entitled Living the Good Life. And it was very, very popular during the 60s, and a lot of us hippies read it and and decided, oh, that seems like a cool idea. Let's get into growing vegetables. And they were doing it organically, so that part was an easy choice.
Sure.
And once I started, I was so fascinated by how well this worked, despite the fact that all of the experts I was reading were putting it down, saying that can't possibly work to do it. And on my garden, it was working.
Uh-huh.
So that was a holy cow moment.
Yeah. So what were other gardeners doing, the so-called experts at the time, that was different?
Well, they were probably PhDs, mm-hmm. and that isn't to suggest that these PhDs were ignorant. I think that they were probably misinformed or miseducated, because the belief in general among agricultural experts was that it was impossible to farm, and especially to farm commercially, as I wanted to do, unless you used chemicals and pesticides, and we were using neither.
Was that due to the kind of not switching crops around, growing one type of product or crop, depleting the soil? Was that the reason they had to bring in all the extra stuff?
Yeah, I would say the organic theorists at the time would have assumed that the fact that they were running a monoculture,
mm-hmm.
and were not returning organic matter to the soil. There are a lot of old books. In fact, you know, I have on my shelf the 1895 yearbook of the USDA, and it has a long chapter in there when it says exactly that, the secret to long-term success in agriculture is to make sure you return enough organic matter to the soil.
So you've been doing this, like we said, for a long time, since the 60s. When did you see a real turning point where it was almost mainstream for organic gardening? It was something that most people had heard about.
Yeah, I think the change came after the Alar incident, when it was exposed that the chemical orchards were using a chemical called Alar, and it was suggested that this was a carcinogen. And at that point, everybody, even those who had no interest in gardening, rushed to their supermarket or to their health food store and wanted to buy organic vegetables. And so that was really the beginning of the interest in organic.
So how do you feel about the organic label? I know it can mean different things to different people. And how do you feel about those labels?
I work with a group of farmers. Most of them are all the old-time, long-term organic growers in the country. And the organization is called the Real Organic Project. And all of us are objecting to the fact that the USDA, which was given control of the word organic, has basically sold it out and are allowing produce from hydroponic farms and from confined animal feeding operations, so forth, to be sold under the organic label, and especially the hydroponic stuff, since in hydroponics there's no soil involved, and in organic, the important thing was how good care you took of your soil.
Right, and I had not even thought about that until I read your book. And yeah, how can that be organic when there's no soil there? So how should they be labeled if they're not organic?
Well, they should be called hydroponic, which the hydroponic industry understands that customers are not running to the store to buy hydroponic produce. And so they have tried to hide what they're doing by piggybacking on the organic label. And they managed to subvert the truth at the USDA in order to allow them to do that.
So one of the main things in your book is talking about seeing the farm as a living organism. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, that was brought up originally back in 1924 when Rudolf Steiner gave a series of lectures. Those lectures were the initial background for biodynamic farming. And the whole idea, the whole idea behind organic in addition, is that the key is to have a biologically active, fertile soil that can digest the organic matter you put into it because of all its microorganisms and everything. And that is the power that makes an organic farm work. And, it appealed to Steiner at the time that was part of the farm itself being alive. And so that was the whole idea behind what he was stressing.
And healthy soil is good in what kind of ways?
Well, the idea of a healthy soil in organics has always been one fed with clean organic matter that you grew on the farm and either collected together and made into compost and spread the compost on your soil, or if it were a soil-improving crop, that you tilled into the soil to mix that organic matter with soil particles that would then help break them down and make those nutrients available to other plants in the future.
And where does, like you said, manure and compost, and you obviously believe that they should come from your own farm rather than bringing them in. Why do you think it's more important that we're to figure out where they come from rather than the fact that you're, you know, you use them?
Well, a lot of the manure available today for organic farms who are looking to purchase it is coming from confined animal feeding operations, CAFOs. And this manure is filled with the wastes of drugs that are used on the animals in those places, but is also very suspect because these animals are all locked away in huge barns or cages somewhere. And the whole idea of organic is that the organic matter that you're putting in your soil to make it fertile enough to grow vegetables is pure, is not polluted. And a lot of the compost available for purchase today comes from municipal waste compost, which is made in many towns with the leaves they collect and the grass they collect and everything. But all of those inputs for the compost come with unintended pollutants. And so many of those composts are hardly the pure compost that most people would like to see their vegetables grown in.
So it kind of comes down to you knowing where everything is coming from and kind of controlling that.
That if you want to be responsible to your customers and provide them with vegetables that are as close to perfect as you can do, that is exactly the thing you should be concerned about.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, we're talking with Elliot Coleman. He has over 50 years of experience in all aspects of organic farming and is the author of many books on organic gardening, including his latest, The Self-Fed Farm and Garden, A Return to the Roots of the Organic Method. What questions do you have about organic vegetable gardening? We would really like to hear from you. So give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Stay with us at noon today. Mark Dwyer will be back with suggestions on how to enhance your winter garden with color and texture. Right now, we are talking about organic gardening with Elliot Coleman. And Elliot, the whole main focus of this book is basically it talks about green fertilizer, cover crops. Talk a little bit about what that is and how important it is to gardening.
Yeah, probably a better name than green manures are soil-improving crops. And these are crops, very often legumes, but they can be grasses, that are grown on the farm. And when they are of a certain maturity, are tilled into the soil to add their organic matter to the soil. And as I've mentioned earlier, adding organic matter to the soil is the way you keep it alive and productive for a long time.
And we'll talk about the use of tillage in just a second, but we do have Dave in Appleton with a question. Go ahead, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I'm not sure if this is a question that you've asked, but this program, it's about biochar. During the winter, I make biochar in the wood burner, and the only thing I can do is spread it on top of the ground in the winter. And then during the summer, when I plant plants, I take it and put it around the plant when I plant it. Is it okay to leave it on top of the soil? Is it better around the plant? And how does that help the plant?
Okay, thanks, Dave. What do you think, Elliot?
Well, the whole idea of biochar originally was to mix it into the soil. And it came about because people have discovered along the shores of the Amazon very, very fertile soils. And what makes them more fertile than the other ones near them is the fact that they're filled with charcoal, and that goes under the name now of biochar if people want to make it and try this concept. Whether lying on top of the soil it would be as effective as when it's mixed into the soil, I cannot say.
Okay. Well, good luck, Dave. I guess maybe experiment, right? You do things like that on your farm, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I experiment all the time. But I had a quick question for you, Jill. Normally, you would talk about books that are how-to. This book is a why-to. Does that change anything in the way you think about asking and accepting questions?
It's a what? I missed the...
Yeah, this book, the Self-Fed Farm and Garden, uh-huh. isn't a how-to. I mean, it does explain how I do it.
Right.
But it's mainly explaining why think that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, that makes sense to me. Let's talk to another caller, Bill in Deerbrook. Go ahead, Bill.
Hello. I agree with you 110%, and I thank you very much for telling the truth. One example I have is about 12 years ago, I tried to grow vegetables, small vegetables organically, and I live near a CAFO, and they spread manure next to my property, and it saturated my soil so much that I can't grow garlic, squash, or anything anymore, and I have no idea what's going on in my soil because every year they just keep spreading, and I'm broke. I'm out of business.
Oh, that's too bad, Bill. Elliot?
Yeah, well, by most people in the organic world, manure is considered an excellent soil improver. But obviously, like anything else, you can have too much of a good thing. And if the manure that's coming from the CAFO near where Bill lives is not processed properly, it can cause all sorts of trouble.
Sorry about that, Bill. That's so heartbreaking. Unfortunately, there's not as many regulations and things for CAFOs as there could be on that. Do you have any problems in your area with those large farming organizations, Elliot?
No, in fact, being on the main coast, which isn't the Midwest with huge farms, mm-hmm. All the farms around here are small farms like ours. And the only large farming is wild blueberries, and that's done quite extensively. But basically, this is a... You would call the farming around here pretty old time. It harks back to the way things might have been done 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So we were talking about tillage. So to your point, why do you use tillage on your farm? A lot of people are saying you shouldn't do that anymore because it brings up the seed weeds or the weed seeds. But how do you use it on your farm and why do you use it that way?
Yeah, I have always tilled on my farm. In fact, I wouldn't have a farm here, a functional farm, if I hadn't tilled organic matter into the soil from the start. We cleared the land that we're farming from spruce and fir forest back starting in the early 60s when we moved here. And land cleared from spruce and fir forest is not notably the most fertile land you're going to find. In fact, this soil had a pH of 4.3 when we began here. Was very sandy and low in organic matter. And so basically, we needed to create this soil before we could successfully farm it. And we did by mixing as much local organic matter. And I can get all the spoiled hay I need around here because so many of the old farms are now owned by summer people, and they have no need for the hay, so they hire contractors with bush hogs to come in and mow the fields around their houses to maintain the farm look. And I'm smart enough to suggest to them when I chat with them that it's very dangerous fire hazard to leave all that dry, flammable grass around your house. And if they want me to come collect it, I would be happy to do it. So I can get all of that I could ever want.
Very kind of you to do that. Great idea. We've got a call from Gianni in Montello who's got a question about fertilizers. Go ahead, Gianni.
Yeah, we also are in an area here in south central Wisconsin where the soil is quite sandy, and I do my best to bring in leaves and organic matter, but I do buy the 10-10-10 fertilizer for our garden in the springtime, and we use it for the corn and the potatoes and all the plants. Can I still be considered organic?
Oh, dear. Well, originally, Gianni, the whole idea behind organic growing was that you didn't use soluble fertilizers, and most of the fertilizers like 10-10-10 that are sold are soluble. In fact, in order to make the rocks that contain phosphorus available, they are treated with sulfuric acid to change the insoluble phosphorus into a more soluble version. And so that was the concept that was followed by the early organic growers. Their preference was to use phosphate rock, the rock that is mined to treat with sulfuric acid to get superphosphate. And, as long as you're putting plenty of organic matter into the soil along with your 10-10-10, you're probably not committing any horrible sins, even from the organic point of view, because many of the chemical companies back years ago were very aware that their chemicals worked better in soil with plenty of organic matter in it. So your combination of the two is probably not that bad.
Okay, Gianni, I guess you've got the okay from the expert. So now in Gianni's case, though, what are some options that he could maybe have on a smaller garden or a medium-sized garden that would continue to make his soil healthier without having to add in the extra fertilizers that he's buying?
Well, the bags of fertilizers, the 10-10-10, those numbers stand for certain amounts of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. Now, in my book, there is a section where I reprint, let me just find this here so I'm quoting it correctly, a pamphlet printed back in the 1940s by a well-known professor of agriculture, in which he said, the air above every acre contains 70 million pounds of free nitrogen. Why are you trying to buy that? And if you think of it for a minute, that is exactly true. And one of the crops you can grow to put nitrogen in your soil is a legume like clover. And you turn that under once it has nodules on its roots, and you would have the nitrogen in your soil. If you got a hold of rock phosphate, which is the most basic form that phosphorus is sold in, it is not looked upon favorably by the chemical people because it isn't instantly soluble, but your soil can make it soluble by all the biological activities that go on in your soil. And the third suggestion made by Cyril Hopkins in this article I was reading is that there are 30,000 pounds of potassium in every acre of normal farmland, 30,000 pounds. And so, again, if you're going to try and get by without chemical potassium, all you need to do is figure out how to make the potassium your soil already contains available. And you do that by making sure there's plenty of organic matter, which means plenty of life in your soil.
Okay. Thank you for explaining that. I mean, this makes sense in so many ways, in that organic farming, budget-wise, can be tight, and not having to purchase something from outside of your farm makes a lot of sense, right?
Makes great sense, mm-hmm. Yes.
So let's talk about this, how we get our soil healthy and basically create our own fertilizer. What's the first thing that needs to be done? What did you do when you cleared your land and you had to enrich your soil?
Yeah, well, the first thing I did was spread limestone because, as I mentioned, the soil under a spruce fir forest in Maine is very acid. The initial pH of our soil was 4.3.
Good for blueberries, so, right?
Yeah, that's why it's blueberry land once it's cleared, unless people want to do other things with it, as we did, so we had to raise the pH. The second thing we added was phosphate rock, which was obviously the easiest way to get phosphorus in there, because once we had lime raising the pH in the soil, we could then grow legumes. Legumes require a soil a lot sweeter than that 4.3 pH. And so we were then taking care of creating our own fertility from what we didn't need to buy, although we did buy the phosphate rock, but from what we could grow in place, which is green manures and cover crops, which then we tilled into the soil to mix them with all the soil particles. The reason that works, and I explain in the book, when organic matter decomposes in the soil, as it will after you till it in, it gives off carbon dioxide, which everybody thinks is something bad. But if carbon dioxide is given off by decomposing organic matter in your soil, it then mixes with soil water and creates a very dilute acid known as carbonic acid. And this acid is given off by plant roots and other things and has been in the soil for millions of years. And it then is there etching minerals out of the soil particles. The soil particles are all small pieces of rock that have been ground up in one way or another. And the key to having a fertile soil is to be able to get a hold of those minerals in your soil. And if you have plenty of organic matter in the soil, you have plenty of carbonic acid, and that's making everything work. And that's the theory that we operate on, and it seems to be very successful for us.
We're talking with Elliot Coleman. He's the author of many books on organic gardening, including his latest, The Self-Fed Farm and Garden, A Return to the Roots of the Organic Method. If you have questions about organic gardening, wondering about the method, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. So let's talk about some of these the plants that you grow for green manure, as we were mentioning. What are some of the best ones, and what do they do for the soil?
Well, basically, they all are adding organic matter to the soil. And let's start with a combination of two, one legume and one grass. And the legume would be hairy vetch, and the grass would be rye grain. And the nice thing about this one, you can plant it later into the fall than any other. In fact, the type of weather we've been having, you could still get out there and put it into the soil. Mm-hmm. And these are very hardy plants, and they will germinate at quite low temperatures. So I think you could establish it now. You then leave it there all winter long, and on as long as you want to next summer before you mow it. If you mow it first, it makes it a lot easier to till in that that rye straw. Mm-hmm. And then wait a couple of weeks, and it will be breaking down and making available the nutrients that it has put into its straw and leaves from the normal things that help stuff grow, like photosynthesis and so on. And that is probably the simplest. One green manure we do use a lot is a combination of peas, field peas, and oats. And we usually sow that in September. Mm-hmm. And we leave that over winter. And it is a great soil protector, but also it has another benefit for those who might not want to till. It winter kills. And so it protects the soil even after it has winter-killed with its dead leaves and stems. But then next spring, and one of those crops, the pea, is a legume. So you have put nitrogen and organic matter into your soil. And when it's dead after the winter, you just rake it aside next spring. You don't have to till. You can just put seeds in the ground, and you've already done a pretty good job on preparing your soil for the new crop.
How often do you do that to your soil? I mean, do you have certain areas where you're going to be using growing like that, and then some others that you're be putting in vegetables? Do you trade them around?
Yeah, the on our farm, about a third of the farm every year is growing winter storage crops that are harvested in the fall and then go into the root cellar. Mm-hmm. And so on that land, that's where we use the rye and vetch, because we can plant them late after we have harvested all of those winter storage in the cellar crops. But on other parts of the land, and as I said, is about a third of our farm, and that moves to a different a third every year with our crop rotation sequence. But other parts of the farm, depending on what next year's crops are going to be, determines what green manures we grow there. And there are some other neat ones, like a forage radish. Here's something people might not think of as a green manure, but this is a great one because Basically, it is a tall radish with a very strong taproot that goes down maybe 4 feet or so and brings up nutrients from way down below. And it protects the soil all winter. It does winter kill. And again, it has created a more fertile soil for you over winter without your having to do anything but rake it aside in the spring. And in the book, I give a whole long list of these. A lot of them are legumes like the vetch. A lot of them are just regular plants like the radish. And some of them are grasses. They all help.
And it's really well explained in the book if anyone really wants to get into it and understand the background. But if you just want to take all your advice, it's easy enough to do, too. I was really interested in the pictures are beautiful. I'm assuming these are all pretty much on your farm, right? Four Season Farm?
Yes. My wife is a very good photographer, and she has taken all the pictures for all of my books, and they greatly benefit from her skill.
Yeah, they are very, very nice. I was really surprised that I'm looking at a picture of a garden, and you've got your, it looked like it probably was some kind of a cabbage or something, but in between is another crop of something, so you don't even see the soil. Is that the way you generally grow, or was that a certain special case?
Okay, that is a green manure technique known as undersowing. And so after the cabbage was growing, I would go through that field underneath the cabbage leaves with a little seed dispenser and spread clover seed. And that would come up in the understories. And if you wait too long to do this, the crop that we're talking about is cabbage, will smother out this undersown legume. But if you time it right, the legume will get established, the cabbage or whatever crop the other crop is will grow together, and you will have both. You will have an improved soil and a heck of a harvest of cabbages.
And that's such a great idea. You also have one with peppers and arugula and keeps the weeds down, I'm assuming?
No, that was, I think that was taken as a joke picture and somehow it ended up in the book. But I did know I needed to have a whole lot of arugula ready for an order in May 1 year, and I didn't have any extra land, so I just went to a bed where I had planted peppers and undersowed, sprinkled the arugula seed in under the peppers and raked it in, and I could go through that pepper bed with my knife and cut and harvest all of that arugula, and then it was out of the way. It was no longer competing with the peppers. And so it was a great way to get two crops off the same land.
It's lovely. We're talking with Elliot Coleman. He has over 50 years of experience in all aspects of organic gardening. His new book is called The Self-Feed Farm, A Return to the Roots of the Organic Method. What questions do you have about organic vegetable gardening? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Next week on the show, Diana Alfith will be back to answer your gardening questions. And then in the last half hour, we'll talk with the author of a fun new book called Chainsaw Love. And yes, it's about chainsaws. Hope you can join us for that because, you know, everybody wants a chainsaw. But right now we're talking about organic garden and gardening with Elliot Coleman. Let's take a call. Pam in Kellogg, Minnesota. Hi, Pam.
Good morning. I have been gardening a very, very, very long time and have never heard of this. I was visiting with a gardener that sells produce this summer, and I asked him how he got to get such good results. And he said he spreads his whole fields with Epsom salts, and I have never heard of that in my life. and I wonder if your guest has.
Well, I have. I don't know about you, Elliot.
Epsom salts contain one of the nutrients often recommended that you add to the soil.
So is it a good thing or a bad thing, or it just depends?
Yeah, I suspect like anything soluble and Epsom salts are soluble. You can overdo it by adding too much, and that may unbalance whatever balance you might need between that and other nutrients. But for the most part, if someone tells you they've been successful with it, you should listen to them because they probably know a lot more than you do.
And find out how much they use, right?
Yes.
Yes. Dennis in Two Rivers emailed to ask if organically grown plants help each other. Oh, I'm not quite sure what he means by that.
Oh, well, as somebody who's been doing this for a long time, I will tell you that one of the first things I learned, and it was from Rodale's Organic Farming or Gardening magazine back when I started, was all the stuff about how organic gardening grows plants that are healthy enough to ward off pests.
Yes.
And I thought that was a fabulous thing. And it turned out the more I experimented with it, the more it was true that it was possible to grow fields of carrots or beets or lettuce and other things without pests being, you know, destroying everything. That would, for the most part, they were ignoring it. And the only crop that hasn't proven in my experience to be totally true with is the potato and the potato beetle. I still see occasional potato beetle problems, even when I think I have done everything correct. But if that's the only problem I have, I'm pretty content.
For sure. There are a lot of people that would be very jealous of just having that particular problem. But you have mentioned in your book, too, that that a healthy soil creates healthy plants that are able to fend off diseases and insects.
Yes, and there is a whole lot of evidence on this in the published studies. And there are a number of researchers in Holland, and I've been fascinated by the stuff they have written. In fact, it almost seems too good to be true. But if certain things fall into place, like you have put the right type of organic matter into the soil and it breaks down in a way that makes its nutrients easily available to the next crop, and the next crop wants them, and so on and so on. It does work. Miraculous as it may seem, it's actually true.
Mm-hmm. And we've heard that before from people who have talked about how important the healthy soil is. So for those who are growing organically, a lot of it's like, well, I have to control these things. But a lot of times you don't have to worry about controlling it if you do it right.
That has been my experience.
Yeah.
Yes, Jill.
Yeah, for sure. So let's talk a little bit about rotating plants. Very important, rotating those crops. How do you decide what crops can be planted when you rotate crops? So how do you intertwine them, basically?
Yeah, years ago, I read that the University of Rhode Island had done 50 years of studies on the effect of preceding crops on subsequent crops. And I went to my local university library where they had all those old studies, and I read them. And it was absolutely fascinating that if you planted onions and then followed them with cabbage, both the onions and the cabbage did spectacularly. If you planted cabbage and followed it with onions, the onions just grew very poorly because they didn't grow well after whatever the cabbage had done to the soil. So there were a lot of, non-scientific, but obviously fascinating connections going on out there between previous crops and subsequent crops. And the basic rule of crop rotation is not to plant the same crop in the same space year after year. But if there is a positive, it would be, for the most part, if you grow almost any crop after a legume, and a legume that has been inoculated so it has nodules on its roots, it will most likely grow a fantastic crop.
And that makes total sense. And we had mentioned tilling before, and when you till, you don't go down very long, far, do you?
No. All of the studies that I've found suggest that organic matter wants to be mixed in just into the top 4 inches of the soil. And that's because oxygen is an important factor in the breaking down of that organic matter, which is what you want to have happen. In fact, when I read a lot about the no-till literature, they're acting as if tilling is going to enhance the breakdown of the organic matter that you till under. And that is 100% true, and that's why I'm doing it, because if I put organic matter into the soil, I want it to break down so its nutrients are available then for another generation of crops.
Yeah, exactly. Deb emailed to ask, how important it is it to have your soil tested?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm the wrong person to ask that question of, Jill, because I had the soil tested once when I first started here. That's how I found out about that 4.3 pH, but I haven't done it since. And I guess I have to say I test the soil with my eyes.
Uh-huh.
And I've been doing it long enough that I can tell by how well the plants are growing, whether the soil is doing what it needs to be doing.
Right. Ruth in Chippewa Falls has a call for us. Go ahead, Ruth.
You were talking about potato beetles, and I grew potatoes, and I left black nightshade in the garden. I always left a few plants in the potatoes. I never saw a potato bug in my garden.
Okay, thanks, Ruth. Combination planting. Have you experimented with that, Elliot?
I haven't, like she has, but the people who have surprised me on potato beetles are friends in Europe who, and this is the other fascinating thing, during the Second or First World War, I forget which, we dropped potato beetles on the enemy in Germany because we knew they used a lot of potatoes and didn't have them over there. And potato beetles have been a problem in Europe since then.
Oh.
But on a friend's farm in Holland, he told me that when he started growing, he had a problem. He changed his crop rotation to try and get more organic matter into the soil. And he got rid of the potato beetle problem, and he had never seen it since.
Excellent. Well, Elliot, this has gone so fast. We're finished. We really appreciate you taking the time to being with us and sharing all of your years of experience with us.
Well, Jill, it's been my pleasure. You're an excellent host, and you know how to ask all the right questions.
Well, thank you for having all the right answers. Again, Elliot Coleman has been our guest, and his book is called The Self-Fed Farm and Garden, A Return to the Roots of the Organic Method. Is your garden looking a little dull? Well, our next guest has some ideas on how to liven it up. This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us today. Mark Dwyer is back with us. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD, and he is the Healing Garden Manager at Edgerton Hospital. We're going to look at some plants that add winter interest to the garden first, but we're happy to take all your gardening questions. Bring them on. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hey, Mark, good to hear from you.
Hey, Jill, thanks for having me on.
You bet. Well, no one can describe you as dull.
Well, thank you. That's the first I've heard that. And that's great.
I'll bet. So, you know, this time of year, gardens can look kind of sad. And quite frankly, I know I'm guilty of this. I just kind of like, oh, the plants are dead. I'm going to ignore it till spring. But we're kind of missing some opportunities, aren't we?
Absolutely. You know, the gardening season in terms of that growing season is coming to an end. But there's a lot of things in our garden spaces we can continue to enjoy. You know, sometimes it's a little understated, or there's some nuances with the beauty of ornamental bark or colorful stems. We still have some fall color in parts of the state. So there's little things we can still enjoy out in the garden, and we certainly can keep active until that snow really flies.
So let's start talking about conifers first. What should we think about when we add these evergreens to our landscape?
Well, it's a great question, Joe, because a lot of times we'll consider conifers as the backbone of the garden and winter interest. And both of those are true, but I think it's important to consider the role that conifers play throughout the growing season as well.
Hey, Mark, yes. I know you're on your cell phone, but we're having a little problems with the reception.
Okay.
Oh, now you're better. Okay. I think, don't move. Keep. What were you saying about that? Okay.
Sure. So, with conifers, they are truly the backbone of the garden. And as we head into the winter months, we start to consider their value as they become more conspicuous. But it's absolutely vital to consider their role throughout the growing season, as they're great in compositions. There's many functional uses of conifers, whether it's a screen or a windbreak or an accent plant. So it is a time of year where we start to see the appreciation of texture in the garden.
Okay. You know what, Mark? We're having a problem again. I tell you what, I'm going to take a little bit of a break, and let's have Joel call you back. Sound good?
Sure.
Okay. Bet. All right. Our guest today is Mark Dwyer. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD, and he's the Healing Garden Manager at Edgerton Hospital. What gardening questions or comments do you have? Join in by calling 800-642-1234, or of course, you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Hope you can join us again next week on Garden Talk. Diana Alfuth will be back to answer your gardening questions. And then in the last half hour, we will talk with the author of a fun new book called Chainsaw Love. Because, you know, you should know how to use a chainsaw in your garden. I hope you can join us for that. Right now, we have got we've got Mark back, and I think his phone connection is much better. There, Mark?
Hi, Jill. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. You sound good. Let's keep our fingers crossed. So we were talking about conifers and how important they are in the landscape. And I've noticed that people either do like all conifers, there's evergreens everywhere, no regular flowers, or they hardly have any. But there's you got to find a happy medium, because they're great for the landscape, aren't they?
They absolutely are. And I think all too often people think they might be restricted by
larger conifers, like, you know, we think of Colorado spruces and large pine trees, and those all have application in the landscape. But there's so many wonderful smaller scaled opportunities beyond functionality, the idea of foundation plants or screening or hedging. We can have some real specimen conifers throughout our landscape, and that includes what are considered dwarf and miniature conifers, just little bun-sized, smaller versions of very colorful textural components, and they should be a part of all our gardens.
What are some of your favorites?
Well, I'm a big fan in our climate, of course, you know, pines and spruce do quite well, but I've been leaning into various fir trees, and I'm a big fan of concolor firs. They tend to have a blue cast to them, and there's larger forms, there's smaller forms. The trick is sighting, you know, knowing what you have for soil, for sunlight, the watering regime, and ultimately considering the fact that these plants will fill space. So really predicting their growth based on the space they're going to fill.
We're kind of bad at that, aren't we?
But we sure can be.
And not only do they have different forms, but they do have different colors, like you said, and different texture.
Well, you know, we all know that green's a color and that we even get starved for seeing more green in our winter months. But conifers run the range of all sorts of shades of blues and yellows. There's many conifers that get a winter coloration, a tinting, if you will. So it's important to really observe the landscape in winter and not only look for conifers that are exciting to you, but certainly in your own landscape, look for lapses of interest or the idea that, hey, you know, a pine tree in this back corner would be nice, or I'd like a little more privacy. So they, again, their functionality has long been established, but their beauty, I think, is absolutely underappreciated.
Yes, for sure. And they act in other ways, too. They're great at blocking out the neighbors or a loud road. So there's different ways to use them. When we're talking about adding color in the wintertime, you had mentioned that some, like shrubs, will have different colored branches, things like that. But we also have berries. And with them, we can bring birds into the garden. What are some good ones for that?
Well, there's some great ones for winter ornamentation, although the ideal scenario is the birds take advantage of the nutrition from berries. And I'll start by saying there are some berry-producing shrubs we don't want in our landscapes, and that includes things like the fruits from burning bush and Japanese barberry and buckthorn. There's a lot of these thuggish plants that are spreading via these berries. So there are some things we want to exclude from our landscapes, but the nice ones include things like, you know, crab apples we're all familiar with, many hawthorns. There's, on my dog walk every day, we walk by a Korean mountain ash that has beautiful fruits right now that the birds will pick off in short order. But including these things in your landscape offers a blip of interest, of course, with the color and interest of the fruits. But again, we want to provide for those birds as well.
Now, sometimes those trees can or shrubs can be kind of messy. So how do we take that in consideration when we do put them in our gardens?
That's a great comment, Jill, because, you know, I've done landscapes for many, many years, and I'm always mentioning, well, you don't want to put that crab apple by the pool or, you know, the patio. And so you consider fruit drop from these plants, many of which will retain fruit. In fact, many crab apples are selected because the fruits will be retained on the tree through the winter months. And very late in winter, the birds will eventually get to them. But placements is vital, not only for providing for the birds and the function of the tree itself or the shrub, but that potential mess is always a consideration in our high traffic areas.
And another thing that we can add to winter for winter interest in our landscape is it's bark, and we tend to forget about the bark. But and it's got a lot more noticeable now, of course, when the leaves are gone. But what are some really good trees or shrubs that can add that interest?
Well, this is the great time of year as the leaves drop to really observe our landscape for those blips of color. And, you know, some commonly used shrubs, for instance, would include yellow stem and red stem dogwoods of all different species and varieties, but those that really get a nice intense coloration of stem in the winter. Many of these colorful stemmed woody plants get more intense hues, if you will, through the winter months as it gets cooler. I've for many years included a flame willow in my designs, and it's a tree that'll get quite large, but by pruning it back, you get fresh new growth, which currently is transitioning to a brilliant orange-red. So ask at your local garden centers and nurseries for colorful stems from those woody plants, but ornamental bark becomes prevalent, whether it's an interesting texture or, you know, I think we're mostly familiar with river birches and their exfoliating, peeling bark. And despite that being a little bit of a messy tree, they have real interesting salmon-colored bark. And mm-hmm. I mean, I love looking at oak trees and shagbark hickories and sycamores. So, you know, snoop around your neighborhoods and you'll see some neat things, folks.
I found a sycamore at the Arboretum but the Ulbricht Botanical Gardens in Madison. And I hadn't really seen one before. And I'm just walking around seeing this trunk. I'm like, what is this? It's so gorgeous. Had no clue. I'd never seen them before. But yeah, I'm surprised that we don't see them more often in our landscape.
Oh, for sure. And I know that sycamore you're talking about, that huge one.
Yes.
But it's important to mention that, you know, with any tree like that, you do consider its proper location and such. And it's not always common to purchase a tree just for interesting bark, but sometimes that's an additional attribute of merit.
Yeah, for sure. Kyle in Wapaka emailed to say that he really kind of dislikes cultivars and non-natives, but two of his favorites that add color to the otherwise drab winter landscape are winterberry and highbush cranberry.
Mm. Yeah, those are two great native North American plants. And winterberries, it's important to mention as a deciduous holly that they have male and female plants. So you need a male pollinator for the ladies. And the fruit set can run the ranges of brilliant reds to yellows to oranges. They do need a little kind of a moist, acidic soil to really thrive, but they're a wonderful shrub. And the highbush cranberries, top-notch fall color, great fruit set, bright red. And viburnums do have some challenges in our landscape with beetles and borers and things like that, but that's an old standard that really is great for birds, as are the winterberries.
Mm-hmm. Would a winterberry do well under, like cedar trees? Asking for a friend.
Sure. I wouldn't try it. They really need as much sun as possible and really well-drained, moist, acidic soils as well.
All right. Lee in Green Bay, you are next. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I would like to know if your guest knows anything about a plant. My wife kind of identified it with her phone. Autumn olive. Is that correct? Autumn olive.
Oh, he's asking his wife, but I've heard of that, right, Mark?
Yeah. So autumn olives, the beautiful silvery leaf, they're quite interesting. They were mass planted back in the 70s. They're quite problematic, in fact, in the landscape. So their planting is not recommended anymore, despite their beauty.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see many of them anymore. They're not very long lived, but again, their silvery foliage is beautiful, and they get an interesting little fruit as well. But again, it's a plant that I don't recommend.
Now, do they have a scent also?
The foliage might have a scent when crushed, but I haven't seen one in so many years.
Uh-huh.
But I used to admire them from afar.
Yeah, they are pretty. And I thought that they had a scent because it seems like someplace where I lived had one and I could always smell it in the spring, summer time. But maybe it was something else, but it was beautiful scent either way. There's so many of those trees and shrubs that we bring into our landscape that we really shouldn't because they will become invasive. What do you do as far as when you select plants? I mean, how do you find out if they're invasive or not?
Well, you know, usually a Google search that references university extension information is good. And, you know, I think most of us in our area are familiar with the ravages of European buckthorn and Tartarian honeysuckle. And so there's a lot of research out there on not only how to identify these plants, but how to control them, which is admittedly challenging. But doing a little research is important because there still are some plants on the cusp of I'm not sure why they're sold anymore. That includes Japanese barberries, and I think burning bushes might be on a list shortly if they aren't already due to the aforementioned bird dispersal of the fruits. So what's interesting in our woodland by the Healing Garden is right now I'm seeing all the burning bush seedlings because they're getting the red fall color. So they're, yes, they're easy to identify right now.
Mm-hmm. So you just have to pull those?
They're super hard to pull. I've got to admit, we're flush cutting them, and we're doing a very direct herbicide application. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that does work with a lot of the invasive, doesn't it? Because they are so difficult to control.
Absolutely. And this is a great time of year. Right now, the buckthorn in particular has its leaves for another couple weeks. Mm-hmm. So you can identify it easily. And you don't want to bother the elbow grease and digging a buckthorn out is difficult. So the idea of a low cut and then a very direct herbicide application on that trunk I found to be quite effective. And the challenge in these buckthorn-ridden woods is the fruit set over so many years, you have a decade or two of control. It's not just what you see, it's what's yet to germinate. So you just have to be on top of it.
Right. And many of them do have berries on them right now. So what do you do with those once you cut them? How do you get rid of them?
Well, yeah, and it's important to mention the females have the berries, so we actually will target the females first, mm-hmm, to be honest, before the birds get to them. We actually dice them up, and we have a brush pile we've put them in at this point, but we have a 15-acre woodland here where we're going to spend 40 years chipping away at literally at these buckthorns. So it's daunting, but it's doable if we all pitch in.
Yep, there you go. Many hands. We're talking with Mark Dwyer today. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD, and he is the Healing Garden Manager at Edgerton Hospital. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call, 800-642-1234. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Mark can take any of your questions about your plants, et cetera, and especially, he's always got some really good ideas about what is new on the market and what's going to look good in your landscape. Another thing that we wanted to talk about, Mark, is container gardening. We think about that in the summer, of course, in the spring, but what do we do with those empty containers in the wintertime? What ideas do you have for us?
Well, one option once you empty them is to flip them over and not worry about them till spring.
That's too easy.
another option is use them as a kind of a vase of sorts. And if you're able to accumulate some evergreen boughs and some stems, and whether that's from your own landscape or you're purchasing from a local florist or garden center, making a winter container can add additional interest. You can put some holiday lights in there. If getting online or other reference materials of books on winter containers, my eyes have been opened over the last decade on the amazing amount of variability that you can include in containers to get that literal fourth season of interest. So it's important to consider that as, again, another opportunity to decorate and offer plants that contribute through the winter season.
And just a comment that if you want to do that, make sure you put those branches in before the soil in them freezes, because they don't go in very well if you wait. So let's go to Sharon in Eau Claire. Go ahead, Sharon.
Hi, good morning. First, thanks to the guest. A lot of great information. I just want to give a personal endorsement for something he said, which was the flowering crabs. I planted some years ago what was supposed to be a dwarf crab. It is now 30 feet tall. Oof. With about a 12-inch trunk. It is glorious year-round. I have the most fragrant blossoms covering the tree in the spring, and then throughout the summer it's gorgeous with its shade and the attraction to the birds. But especially in the fall migration and spring migration for the birds, I get hundreds of cedar waxwings that come for the fruit, both in the fall when they're migrating, and then also robins. So many robins love this fruit, and I actually believe some of the robins winter over because I also have a water source not far away. So just an endorsement for those flowering crabs. They're just wonderful, wonderful trees.
Well, thanks, Sharon. And she's in Eau Claire, so having those robins stick around is kind of unusual.
Yeah, that's amazing. But and again, a great testimony to crab apples and those that have that fruit retention, because it's not just important to feed our winter birds out in the landscape, but those that are returning after, the migration.
Yes, for sure. Now, as far as different kinds of crab apples, what are some of the ones that you would recommend for, you know, our landscape?
Well, it's a challenging question because there's so many, and those that are promoted as disease resistant next year are old hat a couple of years later. So there's always breeding for more improved disease resistance, which can be an issue with crab apples in particular. But there's crab apples that are columnar. There's some that are very small. There's those that have maroon leaves, some that have amazing fall color. I'm a huge fan of, my favorite right now is one called Golden Raindrops. And it's already sequenced through an amazing fall color, which included oranges, yellows, and maroon, which is quite unique in crab apples to have that awesome fall color. Mostly they're kind of yellowish or orange, but the fruit set is just tons of these yellow berries that will actually stay over most of the winter, and then the birds get them later.
Mm-hmm.
There's also one called Royal Raindrops, which is a maroon leaf version, also with great fall color and fruit set. So your local nurseries and garden centers will have some advice on some of the best cultivars out there, but do know their mature size and proper placement, of course.
Yes, cardinal rules. Let's go to Alita in Delavan. Go ahead, Alita.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question, well, two questions, actually. One, and you don't have to answer both, but one is about what's the difference between non-native and a non-natives? Are they always invasive, or could you plant a non-native? That was the one question. And the second one is about a ginkgo tree, which I love their leaves, but I heard that they're not native. But if I pick up the berries from the ground, nobody seems to be eating them. Can I plant them in a container pot and have my own ginkgo tree?
What do you think, Mark?
Well, some great questions. Well, it's important to mention that non-native doesn't mean invasive. So our landscapes have a lot of included plants that can settle right in and won't be problematic in terms of reseeding or invading our landscapes. Now, we've done enough of that where that has been the case. The ginkgo is a great example because as a non-native, I'm a huge fan of ginkgos, love them in the landscape, never worried about them becoming problematic. In fact, they're one of the toughest woody trees we can grow. Doesn't have a lot of interest for native wildlife. That's something to keep in mind. But the comment about the berry, the fruits on ginkgo, the fruits were produced by a female ginkgo. So there's both male and female. Incidentally, the fruits as they ferment are extremely smelly. The challenge with planting them, it's not that you couldn't grow a ginkgo, but you absolutely want to find a male ginkgo due to the concerns about the heavy fruit set, and there's no assurance that what your seedling would become. So most of the male ginkgos are clonal. They've been cloned vegetatively. So what's being sold on the market is what I would encourage you to focus on. And they're slow enough growing. I would say, you know, buy a plant that you know is a male, and there's many great varieties out there. But don't worry, we have to be careful about including invasive plants in our landscapes, many of which are non-native. It's where the research really helps in advance of putting anything in the ground.
Okay, she wanted to know the difference between non-native and invasive. Did we cover that?
Yeah, I guess it's sort of two different topics. So non-native doesn't mean invasive. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some native plants that have become problematic due to spread. So I think there's a little bit of difference in just the terminology, but I hope we addressed it.
Okay, well, great. Thank you very much, Alita. If you've got a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234. You can also send an email, that's talk@wpr.org. Reed emailed us to say that autumn olive is highly invasive, and you may not see it in gardens much anymore, which is good, but it's still very abundant in the wild. And he said that one thing good about autumn olive is that the berries are delicious. He makes jam with them whenever he can. He says, eat your enemy.
There you go.
There you go.
I was trying to remember if it was a seed bird dispersant. It probably is because the fruits are quite small, but I didn't know you could eat them. So that's interesting.
Yeah, that's very interesting because you put, you know, enough sugar on anything pretty much. It's edible.
Right.
you know, it's coming up on the holiday season and a lot of people like to buy live trees to bring in the house for the holiday. And their thought is, well, I can just overwinter this and plant it in my garden, and I'm not wasting money on, you know, throwing away a tree. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the use of live trees is awesome. And I know some folks have done it year after year and included these trees in their landscape. As you're dragging that tree into your living room to decorate it, you should have already dug the hole outside, because it's not, you don't want to keep it as a house plant. In fact, you only want it inside for about 2 to 3 weeks tops, because it'll start, you'll get some active growth, and it has to settle back into dormancy once you take it back outside. There's all sorts of references on how to handle live Christmas trees. The other thing to consider, however, is that most of these, whether it's, say, a Fraser fir or a white pine or some sort of a spruce, they're typically large in the landscape. So when you're spotting its permanent home out in your landscape, make sure you're allowing for growth. But they're not hard to transition outside, and what a great way of enjoying it inside and then popping it back out.
Now, should we be watering them inside?
When you bring them in, they'll be slightly damp, and that's a real good question. So minimal watering. You certainly don't want them to dry out. The idea is you're not losing needles or anything. They're just dealing with your 70-degree interior temperature for a couple weeks, and then you pop them back out, and they settle into that winter dormancy. Do water them heavily outside, even if when you're planting them in that hole. Mm-hmm. I should have mentioned the soil you excavate out of the hole. Put that in the garage or somewhere where it doesn't freeze into a solid ice clunk. You want to have soil you can spread around the tree, so keep that at a warm enough temperature that you're able to actually plant the tree in early January or whenever you take it back outside.
Great. That's a great tip because, that can happen in December. Let's go to the phones again. Jerry and Kakana, go right ahead.
Yes. Is there a way to eradicate foxtails from a field where you have them in just certain areas of that field without killing everything off? I know they're known as a weed, mean seed, like Canadian rye also, which are very harmful for dogs. They kind of have a barb that can, once it gets into the animal, it can just migrate into their internal organs.
Yeah, I'm not sure on that. And when you mention foxtail, are you referring to, is it a type of horsetail, an equisetum? I guess that common phrase, I'm not entirely sure what plant that is, to be honest, so I can't advise on a treatment. Any more information on it?
It kind of grows like Canadian rye is another one, but this one is foxtail, and it's like a grass seed. It almost looks like a wheat or something like that, similar, and has a real bushy type of top to it, and that's why they call it a foxtail, because it looks like a fox's tail, kind of.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, I think I've seen those. I don't know what they're technically called, but yeah, they sound familiar.
Yeah, no, that. Thank you for the clarification, because as a grass, the challenge is any sort of control that focuses on the grass family would damage adjacent grasses if that's a concern. So, aside from spot treatment with some sort of herbicide, I don't think manual control is viable. I don't think you could ever dig and remove it and have it gone simply because it's likely set seed that'll be challenging for many years. So having someone with experience with spot spraying herbicide is probably your best bet, or certainly talk to your local extension agent for some better advice than I'm likely giving here.
Well, good luck with that, Jerry. Let's go now to Dan in Fitchburg. Go ahead, Dan.
Thank you very much for this program. I really appreciate your thoroughness in talking about good plants and invasive plants. Many of my friends work in this area, and we spend 90% of our time taking bad things out. And I especially liked your discussion about burning bush and the bees moving and the birds moving them. So thank you.
OK, Okay. Well, thank you, Dan. I appreciate that. Let's go back to emails. Edna in Retreat emailed that she planted an eastern cedar tree that's about 2.5 feet tall. The nursery couldn't tell her if it's male or female. Now, she knows that she needs a male and a female in order to get berries for the birds, but how can she tell that if she's got a female or a male eastern cedar tree?
I don't know the answer to that. the trick, so eastern cedar is a juniper. That's important to mention. And juniper fruit set is best when there's different junipers in the vicinity for pollination. But in terms of determining the sex of that juniper, I don't know how you would do that. That is a great tree, incidentally, and that's one that actually transitions to kind of a maroonish winter color. And they can get quite large, but I don't think there's an easy way of finding that out. But perhaps planting more, you may have a happy family at some point.
So you need more than one, basically.
Right. Correct.
Okay. All right. Let's go to Karen's email. She wants to know if you could recommend some shrubs or shorter trees for privacy screening under a utility light right of way. It's zone 4-5 and it's part shade.
The challenge under the right of ways is, of course, clearance. You don't want to have an issue where you're getting into the lines. Keeping in mind, there's many times access for utility companies. Anything under a line is fair game if they have to get to the line. So keep in mind there may be an offset, and you may have to sacrifice those at some point. But arborvitae are kind of a dime a dozen. I like arborvitae, which are also called white cedar. And there's some great dwarf and compact varieties, those that aren't going to extend up to 25, 30, 35 feet. There's a great range of them that will get 8 to 12 feet, which is usually perfect for privacy, but yet won't be an impediment on the lines and such. So the challenge with that as a screen is determining the width of the screen. So if you get into larger shrubs, you start adding more width and taking up more square footage. So you might lean towards a series of very narrow plants that fulfill that height range. And again, arborvitae are relatively inexpensive and can form a really top-notch hedge fairly quickly. Unless you have deer, and then I retract everything I just said about arborvitae. So you have to be careful with the nibblers in town there.
Very, very true. And they do come in a lot of different like colors these days too. I mean, there's some really pretty yellowish ones and whatnot. So let's go to Cheryl, who emailed to ask two questions. She has snowberry bushes that have spread like a thicket, and they have white berries that are supposed to be good for the birds, but there's only a handful of them on the bush. Can she cut them down to the ground now? Also, do you have any tips for planting tulips and crocuses in pots now for spring blooms?
Well, the snowberry, the challenge with snowberries is the fruit set can be variable, and the white form is a true snowberry. Incidentally, folks should look into coral berries, proud berries. There's a whole series of these. Most are native species. There are some Asiatic derivatives, but, you know, back to this white fruiting plant, you can cut it back, but it'll take you about 2 years to really get back to that spring flowering and the heavy fruit set. But they grow as a thicket, so that's inevitable. That's just what they do. So do feel you can exert some control on them, but it may take some time for a recovery. The tulips and crocus, the challenge in pots is simply if you're going to be bringing them out into your spring landscape, you absolutely can pot them in a container with soil, fairly shallow, not as deep as you might have to do outside, and then you have to have them go through that winter dormancy, some cooling period, whether that's in your garage where they don't keep freezing rock hard but go through a portion of at least 8 to 12 weeks or more, and you don't have that issue of heavy freezing and thawing where you might crack the pot. The other thing folks do is it's what called forcing bulbs. You actually will pot up bulbs and put them in the fridge if you have the space and the inclination, and with that same cooling period, you can get them to start to grow, and then you pop them into pots and bring them outside. So there's many references on how to do this. The most challenging thing is proper planting depth and long enough cooling period. So I would do a little more research, but it's a fun thing to play with.
Yes, they certainly are. Thanks for the email, Cheryl. David Weyer is our guest today. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD, and he is the Healing Garden Manager at Edgerton Hospital. What gardening questions or comments do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. On Monday, we'll be talking about the importance of PT before surgery. And then we'll look at new treatments for aggressive brain tumors. Right now, we're taking your gardening calls. And we had just had an email about bulbs, Mark. How do you decide where to put bulbs in the healing garden? And also, do you just dig them out afterwards and plant new ones in the fall, or do you keep them for a few years?
Well, both great questions. And I would say, first of all, every bulb we put in the ground, we leave in there. And they're hardy perennials, and the intention is to get many years of enjoyment out of them. You know, in finding locations, we'll be planting bulbs out in the healing garden next week. And the locations we're going to be planting them were already identified in spring. So, folks, look at your spring gaps where you think, boy, I wouldn't mind a little splash of color here. And the challenge is remembering or marking or photographing or
yes.
doing something. But find those locations for those pops of color, or perhaps you include fragrant bulbs closer to that patio or deck. So sometimes it's random, to be honest, and I'm not going to lie. I've dug holes to plant bulbs and been like, oh, I already have bulbs here. So sometimes we just do it willy-nilly, but do identify those gaps in spring if you can. But plant proper planting depth, which is typically 3 times the height of the bulb, as a standard unit of measure, and they'll last for many, many years. And some are better than others. Many are deer-resistant. Some are not. So if you have critter impacts, I'm on a tangent here, but deer and rabbits, you know, love tulips and crocus, so we don't do any of those in the healing garden. We focus on daffodils and alliums, the ornamental onions, because the deer leave them alone. So a lot of considerations, but, you know, get them in the ground, folks.
Yeah, it is getting kind of late. I've got a bag full of them that I need to do myself, so I hear you. Let's go back to the phones. Mike and Eau Claire, go right ahead.
Hello. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I have a quick question. Well, I'm a truck driver in Eau Claire right now, but I'm from Michigan. I planted 29, they're the privacy trees, the arbor, I can't think of the last part of it, the evergreens. And for privacy, they're 5 years old. They're growing great. I've been watering them. My question is, I don't want them getting 12 and 13 feet tall or anything. Can I top those off at like 8 feet tall? And also, can I use the hedge trimmers on those if I have to, if they start getting too bunching up to each other?
And that's arborvitae, I'm assuming, Mike, arborvitae.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. The short answer to both your questions is absolutely yes. So, you know, again, if you can't select a variety that you know will top off at a desired height, you could take what would become a huge arborvitae and when they get to that, say, 10 foot that you want, you can keep them topped. You can use your shears, your hedge trimmers. You don't want to cut too far into the plant. You don't want to get beyond where you see green. But arborvitae are very resilient with shearing and pruning, so you can keep them hedge shaped and any size. But you just have to commit to it because they'll fight you. They'll keep growing. But you can certainly be in control, and it sounds like you have a good plan to do so.
I've seen some really pretty arborvitae hedges. They look really nice. So good luck, Mike.
They do.
Yeah. Jim in Abbotsford, you're next. Go right ahead.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, the question I have is, you were talking about when you cut off an invasive item like a buckthorn and put herbicide on there. What is the best way to do that, to put the actual herbicide on there? Do you use a spray bottle or what?
Yeah. We've been doing two different things with the buckthorn. We've been using a spray bottle, and we want to make sure that we're not getting any chemical anywhere else but that fresh-cut trunk. In fact, we actually will apply herbicide literally right after we make the cut, you know, brush off the sawdust and apply it. We've actually been using, it has a sponge applicator, so it's like a tube with a sponge, so you can kind of just dab it and press it on there. So again, there's a couple different ways of doing it. A spray bottle seems to work, but becomes challenging with some of the thicker herbicides. So whatever way you can do it where you minimize spillage, and again, that direct application in fall tracks right down into the root system, and that's really what will kill the buckthorn. And another tip, by the way, with buckthorn is we cut them now at 2 feet, paint them with the herbicide. Usually by spring, many are already dead. But those that may start to sucker or show any sign of life, we make another cut and apply the herbicide again in spring. Those taller trunks that have already died, we can just kick over within 2 years. So we're literally not digging any buckthorns out. We're being just very careful with the right herbicides and how to apply them, as you've asked.
Is 2 feet just arbitrary or for ease, or is that important to leave 2 feet?
It's arbitrary, so we can see them and know which ones we cut.
Mm-hmm.
The mistake we made is we used to flush cut them and paint them, and then we couldn't find them later in spring until we had all these. The ones that did not die would send up an unbelievable amount of suckers.
Uh-huh.
And then you're dealing with all of those cuts, and you know, the battle is ensued. So we leave the 2 foot so we can see them and then check them out in spring and see what's going on.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for that call, Jim. Let's go to Alice in Prairie du Sac now. Go ahead, Alice.
Hello?
Yep, go ahead.
We just purchased a lot that we're going to put a home on, and on the corner of the lot between us and the neighbor and around a utility pole is a large sprawling lilac tree, and I was wondering if you could give us advice. We'd like to keep it, but it definitely needs to be under control.
Well, question, is it a lilac with many stems?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, because there are true lilac trees that have a single trunk, but this sounds like an old French lilac, which have many, many original stems. They actually can be controlled. There's some great ways of rejuvenating them, which includes getting in there and literally, as low as you can, cutting out the largest trunks. So the oldest portion of the lilac, you're saying, you guys are done, we're going to get you out of there. And what you'll get is some new growth. The younger stems will take over. You also can do some height control, but the challenge with lilacs to not lose the flowering is you want to prune them directly after flowering. So that's not to say you couldn't thin out the old canes or stumps or trunks this winter, and then next spring after it blooms, you can immediately take it back if the height is an issue at all. But you can rejuvenate French lilacs fairly easily, and with a lot of vigor, you can really go at them, and they'll have a new lease on life.
Okay, thanks for the call, Alice. You'll enjoy those lilacs. If you've got a question for Mark, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And, of course, you can send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. What about the lilac trees, Mark? What is a good way to prune those?
Well, ideally, so lilac trees include, in our climate, folks would be able to find Japanese tree lilacs. There's also Peking lilacs. Both of which have a pretty interesting bark, particularly the Peking lilac has an amazing coppery bark. There's a variety called China Snow. But to your question, Jill, as trees, we're just addressing really the cosmetics, but also branching issues. So the tree lilacs I've tended, I might get in there in winter knowing I'm going to lose the spring flowers, but I can see the winter silhouette and I'm thinning some of the crossing branches and doing an architectural pruning. For the most part, they're pretty self-sufficient. You don't need to worry about it. So as a smaller tree, you see lots of them along parkways and in front yards and such, and they tend to bloom later than most of our lilacs. But again, they're worthy of consideration, but you may have to, again, do some structural pruning.
Okay. Yeah, and if you miss a few blooms, you know, once, that's for the better next year. You'll get more blooms, right? Yeah. And as far as pruning goes, we have to be careful about when we prune. So what can we do right now? Should we wait until it gets colder out towards spring?
Well, we're heading into a season where I feel about 90% of, I do 90% of my pruning between literally now and March. So the dormant season as we head into late November, before things start waking up in March. And so the structural pruning we talk about, whether it's larger trees that have deadwood or crossing branches or smaller trees that you're trying to layer a little bit or shrubs that you're pruning back, for the most part, you can do that in the winter season. The lilacs are a great example of one you'd want to do after they bloom. So those plants that bloom on what's called old wood, you tend to prune later after they bloom. So a little research on the plant you're considering pruning would actually tell you exactly when to prune them, but I'm never shy about taking off a broken branch or something that looks goofy. I would do that in winter on anything, to be honest. So start looking at the silhouettes of your trees, folks, and you'll see some things you might be able to tackle.
How careful do we need to be when we're cutting, pruning branches and things? Do we have to clean our pruners in between? I mean, what do we do to prevent some of the diseases that we can spread around?
Well, it never hurts to do that, and a great example would be pagoda dogwood is a smaller tree, a native, and it gets this golden canker where branches turn a brittle gold, and the real danger is if you, say, cut one of those branches and then start pruning some of the healthier branches, you can spread that disease. So sanitizing your tools, whether you're dipping them in a bleach solution or a little Lysol, is not a bad thought. Admittedly, I don't do that with every cut. And so if you're cutting into something where there's a concern about spreading a problem, like if you're removing an issue that you think might be, if for any reason you think it might progress on that tree, you would want to sanitize your tools. But more importantly, keep your tools sharp and ready to go. Mm-hmm. And again, learn proper pruning procedures and how to tackle things appropriately. And you can get a lot of work done this winter, and you won't regret it.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Let's go back to the phone. Wendell in Marinette, what's your question?
My question is about persimmon trees. I live up in Marinette near Green Bay, and I'm just wondering, are persimmons at all, is there a viable variety that would work in Wisconsin?
Well, nice question. You know, I'm in southern Wisconsin, and we can't grow the Asian persimmons. I imagine maybe some folks in Milwaukee, coastal Milwaukee or along the lake might be able to do it. And I know you can be pretty warm near the water up there. American persimmon is quite hardy, and I've seen quite a few in our area. Beautiful blocky bark. I believe they're hardy to zone 4. So if you can, you know, look up American persimmon. And there are some varieties of American persimmon, but it's a wonderful tree and totally underplanted and underutilized. And for those that haven't had a ripe persimmon, they're delicious. So I would do a little more research on what might work for you up north there.
Okay. Yeah, they are a beautiful plant. Worth looking into for sure. Catherine in West Salem, go right ahead with your question.
Yes. Hi, thanks. We have some trees that were planted about 3 years ago, and they're doing very well, but this last summer, spring, they really shot up because we had great conditions with enough rain and sun. So the lead branch is about 4 feet higher than the other branches, so the crown area there, and I just wondered if we let that go, if we do anything with that. You know, there's linden, and most of it's the linden, I would say, most notably, but also in the hackberries.
And that's not unusual. I don't think I would move too quickly to do anything about that, because the challenge is once you prune a leader back, it starts to entertain or encourage multiple leaders, and then you're dealt with some additional pruning. My gut feeling is the rest of the branches will catch up, because the natural form of actually both lindens and hackberries at a young age is quite conical. So there's always a stronger central leader, and then they start widening out and filling out and rounding. So I would leave it for another year or two, because you could always play with the leader later on if this continues to be a problem. But that lushness, maybe the other branches will catch up for you, and you won't have to worry about it.
Okay, thanks for the call, Catherine. Real quick, we've got just a few seconds left, but David in New Richmond wanted to know when the best time is to prune red and white oaks.
So
like white oaks, the dormant season is the way to go. Oak wilt, Google this up, folks. Oak wilt is a horrible disease that spreads via root grass and beetles. And the danger in pruning during the growing season is the vectors, this oak wilt spreading. White oaks are a little more resistant to oak wilt, but the red oak family is, it's notoriously damaging to them. So I prune January into early March in my area for oaks.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for being with us again, Mark. Much appreciated.
You bet. Thanks, Jill.
You bet. Mark's business is called Landscape Prescriptions by MD, and he is also the Healing Garden Manager at Edgerton Hospital. Thanks for joining us today, and thanks to our team for creating our shows every day. Clara Neipert, Joel Patnaud, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, and of course, Larry Mueller. I'm Jill Najo. Have a wonderful weekend.